Welcome to the Celtic Myth Pod Show, bringing the tales and stories of the ancient Celts to your fireside.
Special episode number 4, Autumn Equinox 2008.
Hello, welcome to the Celtic Myth Pod Show. I'm Gary.
And I'm Ruth. We've got a lot for you in this episode, so we're going to skip the contact details. You'll find them at the end of the show as usual. You'll have to excuse my voice being very croaky. Unfortunately, I've got a cold, so please bear with me during this episode. So what have we got in this show?
Well, in this episode, we'll have three great pieces of music, a piece about the meaning of the autumn equinox, a poem from the wonderful Irish poet W.B. Yeats, and a great story from Scottish folklore called the Meester Storworm.
Excellent. So let's kick off with some news and views. For those of us who wish to meet other Celts and share our experiences and thoughts, there are some places on the web where Celts can gather and chat about all things Celtic. Some examples might be Connecting Celts, a website that concentrates on bringing people together, or Celtic Spirit and the Druidic Dawn, which concentrate on more modern Celtic beliefs, and of course our own forums where those that love Celtic mythology can meet.
Yeah, sure. All of the addresses to these sites will be found in our show notes, but we'd like to invite any groups of Celtic-minded people to let us know where they are, and we'll link to you on the website so that we can help all Celtic folk meet and talk as we used to do in the old days.
That would be super. And we've actually become members of some of these groups, and people are incredibly friendly, aren't they?
They are. It's well worth the time.
Well, it's the time of the autumn equinox. But what exactly does that mean? What did it mean to the ancient Celts? Here are a few ideas to trigger your research.
The autumn equinox is the point of the year when day and night are of equal length. The other times this happens in the year is at the spring equinox. In Latin, the word equinox means equal night, or more properly, time of equal day and night. After this celebration, we descend into winter with hours of increasing darkness and chiller temperatures, although in the southern hemisphere, the warmth of new life begins, as at the time of the spring equinox. The autumn equinox, also known as Mabon or Alba Nelved, is the time of the year when night conquers day. After the autumn equinox, the days shorten and nights lengthen. Our American brothers know this time as harvest home, and for our Celtic ancestors, this was time to reflect on the past season and celebrate nature's bounty and accept that summer is now over. Mabon marks a time of rest after hard work, and a ritual of thanksgiving for the fruits of nature.
Did you also know that this particular festival is also known as the second harvest?
No.
It is. It's the second fruit harvest. Now, take our apple tree, for example.
Yes.
At Lunasa, I went out there with one of our lads, and we went and cleared all the apples that were ready to be picked.
And the tree was full, wasn't it?
The tree was absolutely full.
Beautiful.
And we left all the smaller apples. Now, this week, we're going to finish picking. Because
so that's the end of harvest almost, isn't it? It's almost as if it started at Lunasa and has ended now at the equinox.
That's right. And all the tiny apples that we left, all the small apples that we left at Lunasa, are now mature enough for us to go and pick and add to...
They come to fruition, as it were.
Yes, that's right. And then it's time for me to trim down the tree ready for the winter.
That's brilliant. It's a living example of the seasons.
I know, we do. This apple tree is particularly beautiful. It was covered in blossom this spring.
Yeah, I think we mentioned it before, actually.
We did, actually. Yeah. And the amount of apples we ended up with, the whole tree was weighed down with them, wasn't it?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. It's great because we've been able to share them with neighbours and friends and family. And I'm going to be able to do it again. There are so many apples still on there.
Oh, that's great. Let's have some music then, shall we?
Certainly.
This next track is by Soul Vagabond, featuring the stunning Cornish vocals of Jackie Callis from her album Seven Steps to Soul, and it's called Fairy Night. The wonderful lyrics to this song were written by Susan Carroll, and you can find out more about Jackie, Susan and Soul Vagabond in our show notes. Now, enjoy The Fairy Night by Soul Vagabond.
In fairy night the land is far, the home of all is on a star. The moon is bright but gives no light, because it hides the ones from sight. To look upon a fairy's play will mean you see not one more day. Their secret is now kept within a veil of darkness so, so thin. And if you wish, and if you wish to pierce this veil, on a moonbeam ever shall you sail. The fairies guard this secret life that can't withstand a world of strife. But in that realm my light does hide, I keep it there deep down inside. Dare I risk that others know this light within and let it show? Show the fairies, show the play. Release my fear and pave the way. The way to know, the way to know and see around. Another world that does abound. From the corner of a young child's eye, it's always there, it's not a lie. Could it be safe to say it's real? And if I do, will I break a seal? A seal between the life that hides and the life outside that ransom cries. I can't hold back not one more day, for of this place I must now say. I release all secrets and hold them bright. I show the world my inner light. I show the world my inner light.
We're happy now to present a poem by William Butler Yeats, the famous Irish poet called the Rider from the North. Yeats was one of the foremost figures of 20th century literature and was a major driving force behind the Irish literary revival. He was born in 1865 in County Dublin, had an infamous romantic liaison with Maud Gonne, worked with Lady Gregory on bringing the Irish Celtic myths into prose and dramatic form, and finally died in 1939. This piece is taken from his book In the Seven Woods, Poems from the Heroic Age. The Rider from the North by W.B. Yeats.
There's many a strong farmer whose heart would break in two if he could see the townland that we are riding to. Boughs have their fruit and blossom at all times of the year. Rivers are running over with red beer and brown beer. An old man plays the bagpipes in a golden and silver wood. Queens, their eyes blue like the ice, are dancing in a crowd. The little fox, he murmured,
"Oh, what is the world's bane?"
The sun was laughing sweetly. The moon plucked at my rein. But the little red fox murmured,
"Oh, do not pluck at his rein. He's riding to the townland. That is the world's bane."
When their hearts are so high that they would come to blows, they unhook their heavy swords from golden and silver boughs. But all that are killed in battle awaken to life again. It is lucky that their story is not known among men. But oh, the strong farmers that would let the spade lie, for their hearts would be like a cup that somebody had drunk dry. The little fox, he murmured,
"Oh, what is the world's bane?"
The sun was laughing sweetly. The moon plucked at my rein. But the little red fox murmured,
"Oh, do not pluck at this rein. He is riding to the townland. That is the world's bane."
Michael will unhook his trumpet from a bough overhead and blow a little noise when the supper has been spread. Gabriel will come from the water with a fish tail and talk of wonders that have happened on wet roads where men walk, and lift up an old horn of hammered silver and drink till he has fallen asleep upon the starry brink. The little fox, he murmured,
"Oh, what is the world's bane?"
The sun was laughing sweetly. The moon plucked at my rein. But the little red fox murmured,
"Oh, do not pluck at his rein. He is riding to the townland. That is the world's bane." For our second piece of music, we present a track called Light by Sora. She describes herself as an organic, soulful Celtic vocalist with a touch of whimsy. She combines stylized melody lines and narrative lyrics. There's a much more complete biography for Sora on our site in the contributors section. And now, Light by Sora. We've got a fun story for you, which is called The Meester Storeworm, and is an old Scottish folk tale. I've actually seen several versions of this tale, so don't be surprised if you find other variations. Have you got any idea what a storeworm is?
Well, not exactly, but the word worm generally refers to a large serpentine dragon in folklore, So this could be a dragon tale. It certainly sounds a monster in the tale.
Sure, well, this particular version of this tale comes from the book Tales of Folk and Fairies by Catherine Pyle. and you can find the details in our show notes.
There was once a lad, and what his real name was nobody remembered, unless it was the mother who bore him. But what everyone called him was Ashypaddle, and they called him that because he sat among the ashes to warm his toes. He had 6 older brothers, and they did not think much of him. All the tasks they scorned to do themselves, they put upon Ashypaddle. He gathered the sticks for the fire. He swept the floor, he cleaned the byre, he ran the errands. And all he got for his pains were kicks and cuffs and mocking words. Still, he was a merry fellow, and as far as the words went, he gave his brothers as good as they sent. Ashypaddle had 1 sister, and she was very good and kind to him. In return for her kindness, he told her long stories of trolls and giants and heroes and brave deeds. And as long as he would tell, she would sit and listen. But his brothers could not stand his stories, and used to throw clods at him to make him be quiet. They were angry, because Ashypaddle was always the hero of his own stories, and in his tales there was nothing he dared not do. Now, while Ashypaddle was still a lad, but a tall, stout one, a great misfortune fell upon the kingdom. For a storeworm rose up out of the sea, and of all storeworms it was the greatest and the worst. For this reason it was called the Meester Storeworm. Its length stretched half around the world, its 1 eye was as red as fire, and its breath was so poisonous that whatever it breathed upon was withered. There was great fear and lamentation throughout the land because of the worm, for every day it drew nearer to the shore. And every day the danger from it grew greater. When it was first discovered, it was so far away that its back was no more than a low, long, black line upon the horizon. But soon it was near enough for them to see the horns upon its back, and its scales, and its 1 fierce eye, and its nostrils that breathed out and in. In their fear, the people cried upon the king to save them from the monster. Well, the king had no power to save them any more than any other man. His sword, Snickersnapper, was the brightest and sharpest and most wonderful sword in all the world. But it would need a longer sword than Snickersnapper to pierce through that great body to the monster's heart. The king summoned his counsellors, all the wisest men in the kingdom, and they consulted and talked together, but none of them could think of any plan to beat or drive the storeworm off, so powerful it was. Now there was in that country a sorcerer, and the king had no love for her. Still, when all the wise men and the counsellors could think of no plan for destroying the storeworm, the king said,
Let us send for this sorcerer, and have her brought before us, and hear what she's got to say. For it would seem there is no help in any of us for this evil that's come upon us.
So the sorcerer was brought, and she stood up in the council and looked from one to another. Last of all, she looked at the king, and there her eyes rested.
There is 1 way, and only 1 by which the land can be saved from destruction. Let the king's only daughter, the Princess Gem Lovely, be given to the storeworm as a sacrifice, and he will be satisfied and quit us.
No sooner had the sorcerer said this than a great tumult arose in the council. The councillors were filled with horror, and cried aloud that the sorcerer should be torn to pieces for speaking such words. But the king arose and bade them be silent, and he was as white as death.
Is this the only way to save my people?
It is the only way I know of.
The king stood still and white for a time.
Then, if it is the only way, so let it be. But first let it be proclaimed far and wide throughout my kingdom that there is an heroic deed to be done. Whosoever will do battle with the storeworm and slay it or drive it off shall have the Princess Gemlovely for a bride, and half of my kingdom, and my sword Snickersnapper for his own. And after my death, he shall rule as king over all the realm."
Then the king dismissed the council, and they went away in silence, with dark and heavy looks. A proclamation was sent out as the king commanded, saying that whoever could kill the stallworm or drive it away should have the princess, and the half of the kingdom as a reward, and the king's sword, and after the king's death should reign over the whole realm. When this news went out, many a man wished he might win these three prizes for himself. For what better was there to be desired than a beauteous wife, a kingdom to reign over, and the most famous sword in all the world? But fine as were the prizes, only 36 bold hearts came to offer themselves for the task, so great was the fear of the stallworm. Of this number, the first 12 who looked at the stallworm fell ill at sight of him, and had to be carried home. The next 12 did not stay to be carried, but ran home on their own legs, and shut themselves up in strong fortresses. And the last 12 stayed at the king's palace, with their hearts in their stomachs, and their wrists too weak with fear to strike a blow, even to win a kingdom. So there was nothing left but for the princess to be offered up to the stallworm, for it was better that one should be lost, even though that one were the princess, than that the whole country should be destroyed. And there was great grief and lamenting throughout the land, for the Princess Gemlovely was so kind and gentle that she was beloved by all, both high and low. Only Ashiepattle heard it all unmoved. He said nothing, but sat by the fire and thought, and thought. And what his thoughts were, he told to nobody. The day was set when the princess was to be offered up to the stallworm, and the night before there was a great feast at the palace, but a sad feast it was. Little was eaten, and even less was said. The king sat with his back to the light and bit his fingers. No one dared speak to him. In the poorer houses there was a great stir and bustle and laying out of coats and dresses, for many were planning to go to the seashore to see the princess offered up to the stallworm, though a gruesome sight to be to see. Ashiepattle's father and brothers were planning to go with the rest, but his mother and sister wept, and they said they would not see it for anything in the world. Now Ashiepattle's father had a horse named Feetgong, and he was not much to look at. Nevertheless, the farmer treasured him, and it was not often he would let anyone use him but himself. When the farmer rode Feetgong, he could make him go like the wind, none faster, and that without beating him either. And then when the farmer wished him to stop, Feetgong would stand as still as though he were frozen to the ground. No one could make him budge. But if anyone other than the farmer rode him, then it was quite different. Feetgong would jog along. Not even a beating would drive him faster. And then if one wanted him to stop, well, that was as hard to do as it was to start him. Ashiepattle was sure there was some secret about this, and that his father had a way to make him go that no one knew about. But what that way was, he could not find out. The day before the beauteous Gemlovely was to be sacrificed, Ashiepattle said to his mother, "Tell me something, mother. How is it that Feetgong will not go for you, or my brothers, or anyone? But when my father mounts him, he goes like the wind, none faster." Then his mother answered,
"Indeed, I do not know.
It seems a strange thing that my father would not tell you that, and you're his own true wife."
To this, his mother answered nothing.
"A strange thing, and in all the years you've lived together, not a thing have you kept back from him, whether he wished it or no. But a good husband must always hold back some secret from his wife."
Still his mother spoke never a word, but Ashiepattle could see that she was thinking. That night, Ashiepattle lay awake long after the others were asleep. He heard his father snoring, and his brothers too, but it seemed that his mother could not sleep. She turned and twisted and sighed aloud, until at last she awakened her husband.
"Oh, what ails you, woman? But you turn and twist in bed and sigh so loud that a body scarce can sleep."
"It's no wonder I sigh and cannot sleep. I've been thinking and turning things over my mind, and I can see very plainly that you do not love me as good as a husband should love his wife.
How can you say that? Have I not treated you well all these years? Have I not shown you my love in every way?
Yes, but you do not trust me. You do not tell me what is in your heart.
Well, what have I not told you?
You've never told me about Feetgong. You've never told me why it is that he goes like the wind whenever you mount him. And when anyone else rides him, he's slow, there's no getting anywhere with him.
Then she began to sob as if her heart would break.
You do not trust me.
Wait! What? This is a secret I'd never thought to tell anyone. But since you set your heart on knowing, listen, only must promise not to tell a living soul what I tell you now.
I do promise, my husband.
Right. Well, then this is it. When I want Feetgong to go moderately fast, I slap him on the right shoulder. When I want him to stop, I slap him on the left shoulder. And when I want him to go like the wind, I blow upon the dried windpipe of a goose that I always carry in the right-hand pocket of my coat.
Now, indeed, I know that you love me when you tell me this.
Oh, perhaps we can get some sleep then,
said his wife. And then she went to sleep, for she was satisfied. Ashiepattle waited until near morning. Then he arose and dressed himself. He put on the coat of one brother, and the breeches of another, and the shoes of a third, and so on, for his own clothes were nothing but rags. He felt in the right-hand pocket of his father's coat, and there, sure enough, he found the dried windpipe of a goose. He took that, and he took a pot of burning peat, and covered it over so that it would keep hot, and he took also a big kitchen knife. And then he went out, and he led Feetgong from the stable. He sprang upon his back, and slapped him on the right shoulder, and away they went. The noise awoke the good man, and he jumped from the bed and ran to the window. There was someone riding away on his dear Feetgong. He called out at the top of his voice.
Oh, hi-hi-ho! Feetgong war!
And when Feetgong heard his master calling, he stopped and stood stock still. But Ashiepattle whipped out the dried windpipe of the goose and blew upon it. And away went Feetgong like the wind. None could go faster. No one could overtake them. After a while, and not so long either, they came to the seashore. And there, a little way out from the shore, lay the king's own boat, with the boatman in it. He was keeping the boat there until day dawned. Then the king and his court would come, bringing the beauteous Gem Lovely to offer up to the Storeworm. They would put her in the boat and set the sails to carry her toward him. Ashiepattle looked out across the water, and he could see the black back of the beast rising out of the sea like a long, low mountain. He lighted down from Feetgong and called across the water to the boatman. Hello, friend. How fares it with you out there?
Bitterly, bitterly. Here I sit and freeze all night, for it is cold on the water, and not a soul except for myself, but what is safe asleep in a good warm bed.
I have a fire here in the pot. Draw your boat into the shore and come and warm yourself, for I can see even from here that you're almost perished.
That I may not do. The king and his court may come at any time now, and they must find me ready and waiting for them as the commands were.
Then Ashiepattle put his pot down on the shore and stood and thought a bit. And suddenly he dropped on his knees and began to dig in the sand as though he'd gone mad.
Gold! Gold!
What is the matter? What have you found?
Gold! Gold!
Shouted Ashiepattle, digging faster than ever. The boatman thought Ashiepattle must certainly have found a treasure in the sand. He made haste to bring the boat to land. He sprang out upon the shore, and pushing Ashiepattle aside, he dropped onto his knees and began to scoop out the sand. But Ashiepattle did not wait to see whether he found anything. He caught up the pot and leapt into the boat, and before the boatman could stop him, he'd pushed off from shore. Too late the boatman saw what he was doing. He ran down to the edge of the water and shouted and stormed and cried to Ashiepattle to come back. But Ashiepattle paid no heed to him. He never even turned his head. He set the sail and steered over towards where the great monster lay, with the waves washing up and breaking into foam against him. And now the dawn was breaking. It was time for the monster to awake. And down the road from the castle came riding the king and all his court, and the Princess Gemlovely rode among them on a milk-white horse. All the colour was gone from her face. She looked as white as snow. When the king and all the others reached the shore, there stood the boatman,
wringing his hands and lamenting, and the boat was gone.
What's this? What have you done with my boat? Why are you standing here?
Look, look!
Cried the boatman, and he pointed out to sea. The king looked, and then first he saw Ashiepattle in the boat, sailing away toward the monster, for before his eyes had been dim with sorrow, and he had seen naught but what was close before him. The king looked, and all the court looked with him, and a great cry arose, for they guessed that Ashiepattle was sailing out to do battle with the Stoorworm. As they stood staring, the sun shone red and the monster awoke. Oh, slowly, slowly, his great jaws opened in a yawn. And as he yawned, the water rushed into his mouth like a great flood and on down into his throat. Ashiepattle's boat was caught in the swirl and swept forward, faster than any sail could carry it. And then slowly the monster closed his mouth, and all was still save for the foaming and surging of the waters. Ashiepattle steered his boat close in against the monster's jaws, and it lay there, rocking in the tide, while he waited for the Stoorworm to yawn again. And presently, slowly, ever so slowly, the great jaws gaped, and the flood rushed in, foaming. Ashiepattle's boat was swept in with the water, and it was almost crushed against one of the monster's teeth. But Ashiepattle fended it off, and it was carried on the flood down into the Stoorworm's throat. Oh, down and down went the boat with Ashiepattle in it, and the sound of surging waters filled his ears. It was light there in the monster's throat, for the roof and the sides of it shone with phosphorescence so that he could see everything. As he swept on, the roof above him grew lower and lower, and the water grew shallower and shallower, for it drained off into passages that opened up from the throat into the rest of the body. At last, the roof grew so low that the mast of the boat wedged against it. And then Ashiepattle stepped over the side of the boat into the water, and it had grown so shallow it was scarce as high as his knees. He took the pot of peat, that was still hot, and the knife, and went a little further until he came to where the beast's heart was. He could see it beat, beat, beating. Ashiepattle took his knife and dug a hole in the heart, and he emptied the hot peat into it, and then he blew and blew on the peat. He blew until his cheeks almost cracked with blowing, and it seemed as though the peat would never burn. But at the last, it flared up. The oil of the heart trickled down upon it, and the flame burst into a blaze. Higher and higher waxed that fire. All the heart shone red with the light of it. Then the lad ran back and jumped into the boat, pushed it clear of the roof. And none too soon, for as the fire burned deeper into the heart, the monster felt the burn of it and began to writhe and twist. Then he gave a great cough that sent the waters surging back out of his body and into the sea again in a mighty flood. Ashiepattle's boat was caught in the rush and swept like a straw up out of the Stoorworm's throat and into the light of day. The monster spewed him and his boat all the way across the sea and up on the shore, almost at the king's feet. The king himself sprang from his steed and ran and helped Ashiepattle to his feet. And then everyone fled back to a high hill, for the sea was rising in a mighty flood with the beating and tossing of the Stoorworm. Then began such a sight as never was seen before, and perchance will never be seen again. For first, the monster flung his tail so high that it seemed as though it would strike the sun from the sky, and next it fell into the sea with such a slap as sent the waves high up on the rocks. And now it was his head that flung aloft, and the tongue caught on the point of the crescent moon and hung there. And for a while it looked as though the moon would be pulled from the sky. But it stood firm, and the monster's tongue tore, so the head dropped back into the sea with such force that the teeth flew out of its mouth, and these teeth became the Orkney Islands. Again its head reared high and fell back, and more teeth flew out, and these became the Shetland Islands. And the third time the head rose and fell and teeth flew out, and they became the Faroe Islands. So the monster beat and threshed and struggled, while the king and the princess in Ashiepattle and all the people looked on with fear and wonder at the dreadful sight.
But at the last, the struggle became weaker, for the heart was almost burned out. And then the stoorworm curled up and lay still, for it was dead. Its great coils became the place called Iceland. So was the monster killed, and that was the manner of his death. But the king turned to Ashiepattle and called him son, and took the hand of the Princess Gemlovely and laid it in the lad's hand, for now she was to be his bride, as the king had promised. And then they all rode back to the palace together, and the king took the sword Snickersnapper and gave it to Ashiepattle for him to keep as his own. A great feast was spread in honour of the slaying of the stoorworm. All who chose to come were welcome, and all was mirth and rejoicing. The honest farmer, Ashiepattle's father, and his mother and his sisters and his brothers heard of the feast, and put on their best clothes and came. But the farmer had no feetgong to ride. When they entered the great hall and saw Ashiepattle sitting there at the king's right hand in the place of honour, with the Princess Gemlovely sitting beside him, they could hardly believe their eyes, for they'd not known he was the hero that everyone was talking about. But Ashiepattle looked at them and nodded, and all was well. Not long after that, Ashiepattle and the princess were married. Oh, and a grand wedding it was, I can tell you. And after the old king died, Ashiepattle became ruler of the whole realm, and he and the princess lived in mutual love and happiness together the rest of their long lives. Our last piece of music is a song by Kellyanna called Morgana from the Lady Moon album, which is about a fey priestess of Avalon. We introduced Kellyanna to you in our Lunasus show, and we're proud to bring you this track, which walks through both Arthurian and fey worlds. More information about Kellyanna and her music can be found in our show notes for this episode, or in the contributor pages on our website. So this is Morgana.
Avalon, ancient wisdom, Lady Morgane of the fairies, will you be lost again in the other world? So many days, so many nights, no sense of place, no sense of time, oh Morgana. So many days, so many nights, no sense of place, no sense of time, oh Morgana. Morgan Le Fay, born of kings and queens, ancient powers and ancient mysteries. The fairy people, they were her kin, and when she lost her way, they would take her in. So many days, so many nights, no sense of place, no sense of time, oh Morgana. So many days, so many nights, no sense of place, no sense of time, oh Morgana.
Let's have some listener feedback.
We've recently received an email from Anne, who says she loves Celtic tradition and asks could we please do some of the Welsh tales.
Ah, thank you so much for your email, Anne. I'm pleased to be able to tell you that we will be covering the Welsh tales, as indeed we will cover the tales of all the Celtic nations. I'm really glad to receive this email from you, because it's given us an opportunity to remind all of our listeners that we have a poll running on our website, yeah? To help us decide which of the tales that you'd like us to cover next.
That's right. Would you like us to move on to the tales of Cathulain in the Ulster cycle, cover the Welsh or the Scottish myths, or maybe the Arthurian stories, or look for some of the lesser-known tales? Let us know by voting in that poll.
I think at the moment, the voting is level-pegging, more or less.
I think it is, yes.
Between the Irish tales and the Welsh tales, with the Cathulain cycle just in the lead. We will do them all. It would just be nice to know which you would like us to do next.
So please do pop along to the website and vote for your favourite tales. We've come to the part of the show where we can bring you a couple of promos for podcasts that you might be interested in. The first is British History 101, an enthusiastic look at important events and personalities in British history.
And the second is From the Edge of the Circle, a pagan podcast discussing issues arising for modern pagans. Tommy Elf brings us the show, and whilst not all of his topics address Celtic issues, episode 16 is worth a listen because it discusses the importance of mythology in our everyday lives.
Good evening. This is Michael Anthony, and you're listening to British History 101. This is the podcast's first episode, so I'd like it to be an explanatory prelude to what the future may bring. My vision for this podcast is to provide a basic and intermediate level of British history, something the novice scholar and Anglophile can both enjoy simultaneously. I'd like to do profiles on British monarchs, overviews of significant battles and political events, and some trivia on British culture and society every now and then. My most pressing concern is the audience. What do you want to hear? What type of things are you interested in within the realm of the British Isles? I'd like to include a weekly question and answer once this podcast builds a listener base, so start thinking about things you'd like to know but have never had a chance to find out. Send suggestions, questions, comments, rants, and raves to BritishHistory101@gmail.com. Also, check out my blog at www.BritishHistory101.blogspot.com for a transcript of each show. Until next time, when we begin our three-part series on the Battle of Hastings, my best to you all, and thanks for listening. Have a good night.
Hi, this is Tommy Elf, host of From the Edge of the Circle. From the Edge of the Circle is a pagan podcast out of the Dallas-Fort Worth metro mess in Texas. Each show, I try my best to tackle subjects on paganism from my own personal perspective. I also highly encourage audience participation through emails, voicemails. Hell, I'll even take carrier pigeon if you can train it to locate me. The podcast is located via iTunes or by going directly to the RSS feed at edgeofcircle.libsyn.com/RSS. Come on over, have a seat at the edge of the circle, and let us all know your perspective too. I'm looking forward to hearing from you, and thanks for downloading the show.
Well, that brings our holiday special almost to a close. In the Northern Hemisphere, we're about to head into the darkness of winter. And in the Southern Hemisphere, you're about to face the onset of summer, you lucky people.
So out with those woolly scarves and the hot chocolate. Or time to dig out the summer dresses and enjoy the season.
Slongavoya.
Slongavoya. Yeats was one of the foremost figures of 20th century literature and was a major driving horse.
The boatman thought Ashiepattle. Bim, 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 bim.
You've never told me about Fi-Gong. You never told me why it is that he gets the wind whenever you mount him. And whenever... what did I say?
You never told me why he gets the wind whenever you mount him.
Yes.
We might have to do that one again.
You've been listening to the Celtic Myth Pod Show, available from CelticMythPodShow.com. We hope you've enjoyed the show and will stay tuned for the next episode. You can send us a quick email or voice feedback by emailing either Gary, that's G-A-R-Y, or Ruth, R-U-T-H, at CelticMythPodShow.com. You can chat to us in the forums on our website. The show notes for this episode can also be found on the website. We'd like to say a special thank you to Coulan's Hounds, who provided us with the theme music for our show. You heard Haghole at the beginning and are listening to The Skylark now. You can find out more about this foot-stomping band at www.sfhounds.com. And thanks again to Diane Arkinstone and Kim Robertson, whose music has been used for some of the incidental music in this podcast. You'll find links to their websites in our show notes.